It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's the new film Dinner Rush, about a night in a New York City restaurant of the moment. We talk with director-producer Bob Giraldi. He's captured the frantic trendiness and that brutal pressure that exists in today's restaurant scene. This is no warm, fuzzy Babette's Feast. This is the kitchen as a war zone. On the flip side, Jane and Michael Stern take us out for some laid-back mole in Cathedral City, California. Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan answers that pressing question, to decant or not to decant. And then comedian Catherine Michon reports on California's competitive cooking scene. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Do you know that we're in the midst of an apple renaissance? Now, I realize that for most people, this is not earth-shaking news, but over the past couple of years, old apple varieties have made a huge comeback. And then there's the new ones, packed with character. And what about all this organic growing that's going on? Food experts used to love to shake their fingers at us, saying the problem with food in America is that it all looks good, but it has no taste. Not true anymore. If we didn't know what flavor was about, no one could sell all these different kinds of apples. So here's the deal. Cash in on all this great eating. Forget the ubiquitous delicious apple. It's one of the great oxymorons of the fruit world. Instead, treat yourself to a new apple every time you shop. Buy just a couple to see what you think. Get to farmers' markets and orchards to discover what's local. Last year, for instance, I found an apple called the Red Free. It was sweet and tart and really good with meats and in green salads. Now, here's some other types to look for. Each one tastes different. For instance, the Braeburn. This one is the steak of the apple world. It has big, meaty character. The Prairie Spy has punch. It's snappy with tang and sugar. The Fuji is like eating spring flowers. It's delicate and sort of sprightly. Wine Sap tastes just like its name, juicy and wine-like. And speaking of names, old varieties sometimes have wonderful ones, like the Keepsake, the Northern Spy, or the very British Peas Good Nonesuch. So let's take a look at cooking with apples. When it comes to cooking and baking, apples fall into two categories. Either they hold their shape in cooking, or they melt down to a creamy mush. Now, remember that heat mutes flavors, so go for bold and distinctive-tasting apples when you're going to cook with them. For apples that stay firm in dishes like pies and sautés and pancakes and that kind of thing, keep an eye out for Ashmead's Kernel. It's an heirloom that's puckery tart with a big, full flavor. Also try Newton Pippin, Braeburn, Northern Spy, Harrelson, and the good old Wine Sap. My vote for the best, easy-to-find pie apple is the Granny Smith. Forget the Golden Delicious. This is wimp food. It has no character. The Granny Smith has verve, and they stay firm in cooking. The other thing about pie is to consider mixing a couple of different kinds of apples. Do one for tartness and maybe another one for a lot of sweetness. Now let's take a look at apples that are great for applesauce because they break down when they cook. Check out Rome Beauties, McIntosh, Baldwin, McCoon, or Cortland's. And I've got an applesauce tip for you. Buy organic apples and cook the whole apple, seeds, peel, and all, until it just breaks up. Then pass the whole thing through a food mill. You'll get all the dimensions of taste that way. For another take on apples, make cider syrup. Now, this is where a really wonderful unpasteurized cider from a good mill really shines. You're going to boil it, so you shouldn't worry about any potential danger from harmful bacteria. Take your cider, figure for every cup of syrup, you're going to need about 6 cups of the cider. Put it in a big pot and boil it down until it's thick and syrupy. Cool it, pour it into a pretty bottle, and refrigerate up to 2 months. Cider syrup is sweet and tart and has a lot of depth of taste. Use it where you'd use maple syrup, but try it too in pan sauces, over roasted root vegetables. It's sensational on pork or country ham, or streaked, just a little bit of it, over crusty grilled salmon. In the dessert realm, cider syrup is luscious over panna cotta, apple sorbet, pound cake, or streak it over an apple tart. So open up your apple vocabulary. Every time you shop, try an apple you've never heard of, do a batch of cider syrup, and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the place you can register for Target's own kitchen essentials, hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today, director Bob Giraldi takes us inside the making of his new movie, Dinner Rush. This is not your usual cozy little food film. It's set in a trendy New York trattoria, and the film's about a frenzied kitchen, impossible diners, the mafia, murder, and what happens when a food critic's in the house. Master of wine Mary Ewing Mulligan explains decanting, when to do it, and why bother. Jim Leff, creator of ChowHound.com, talks the new political side of dining out. Comedian Catherine Michon, author of The Girl Genius Guide to Life, reports on competitive cooking at the Santa Barbara County Fair. And then, as we do every week in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, you know, it's tough to find a simple, honest meal in the area around Palm Springs and Palm Desert, which is so rarefied in so many ways. But I think Jane and I found one at a place called El Galito in Cathedral City.
I think El Galito means the little rooster, and this is just a little restaurant that's been there since 1978. It's very simple. They serve tacos, chili rellenos, enchiladas, burritos. My favorite dish is their red and green chili. You get a plate where you either get chili with red sauce or chili verde, and chili Colorado, which is also beef in a peppery red sauce. All of those are very good.
My personal favorite dish is the chicken mole, which is available only on Friday. It's a really wonderful smoky mole with a real pepper zest. Then the chicken just falls off the bone. It's so tender.
But, okay, I have to just say one thing here. What we really love about this restaurant,
yes,
is Michael and I mean, the food is wonderful. And as Michael said, it's hard to find anything down to earth in this, you know, very fancy schmancy part of California. But we're suckers for any restaurants that have a lot of rules. And El Galito is run by somebody whose control is obviously an issue. On the menu, Michael's talking about how much he likes the chicken mole, which is wonderful. But on the menu, it says very sternly, it is impossible to debone the chicken entirely, so it is possible that you may find a bone in your chicken entree. Then somewhere else in the restaurant, it says, we are not a bar. It says, we will not serve anybody who appears to have been drinking.
Another sign says, if you have reservations, you are in the wrong place.
The other sign says, cash only. So if you manage to overcome the fact that your chicken might have a bone in it, you're not a drunk, you have cash in your pocket.
And you haven't made a reservation.
You're welcome to dine at El Galito, and it is worth going through the checklist.
Who created this control center?
We don't know the proprietors, Mr. and Mrs. El Galito, as far as we're concerned. But it's really a kind of charming little place, rules notwithstanding. I mean, it's got that kind of charm of a kind of folksy down-home place like you'd find in a border town in Texas, which is so especially unusual in this part of California.
You know what it is about these wacky rules that appeal to us? And some of our favorite places around the country, you know, do have these kind of, you know, handwritten signs saying, you know, do not or mm-hmm, do this or mm-hmm, step mm-hmm. left or step right. Is usually that mindset carries over into the kitchen, and the food is done. There's usually a cook or a chef there that has an absolutely written in stone way of preparing the food correctly. So if the food is good, you know you can go back time and time and time again, and you're going to get the same quality food. I mean, if they're that bossy with the patrons, imagine what they must be like behind the kitchen door.
This is a good way to judge a restaurant. I never thought of this.
The more rules, the better.
Yeah, and just saying no shirts, no service, you know, forget, that's not enough. We need more direction.
You need more rigidity.
Right.
Was there anything else in Cathedral City that we shouldn't miss?
Yes, there's a thrift store just down the road from El Galito. And what's great is that because it's a thrift store in the Coachella Valley, every item in it is something that you and I can't even afford secondhand.
And it's since the 1970s are back. I mean, if you want to look like Jacqueline Suzanne, this thrift shop has wall-to-wall poochies or poochie imitations.
So if you need a new tiara, Lynn, this is the place to go.
The thrift store near Palm Springs. Hey, thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, wander to the world with me, and any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
The Stern's newest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. You can hear them here every week on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Ewing Mulligan is joining us. Now, Mary was the first woman in America to earn the prestigious Master of Wine. It's like getting a PhD. She comes by from time to time to talk the hows and whys of wine. Hey, Mary, hi.
Hi, Lynn.
You know, today I want to talk about decanting, because I see people doing this, and I think a lot of us are confused about it. When do you decant a wine, and when don't you decant a wine?
Well, there are basically two occasions when you can decant a wine. You can decant it when your wine is very young, or you can decant it when your wine is very old. And in the middle, pretty much, you don't decant. So, you know, a wine that's too young to drink with pleasure as it is, straight from the bottle, or a wine that's quite old. And actually, the reason that you decant a young wine and the reason that you decant an older wine, there are two separate reasons.
Okay, so what are the reasons?
Well, you decant a young wine, and let me just pause for a second and explain. Decanting, of course, is just pouring the wine from the bottle into another container. Mm-hmm. And that container could be a fancy decanter. It could be just a simple carafe. It could even be a pitcher. It really doesn't matter what the container is, as long as it can hold a whole bottle's worth of wine. And you decant young wines when you feel that they need air, and that the exposure to air that they get as they're being poured off and as they're sitting in this container that has a bigger air surface than the bottle itself does, that this air will soften their tannins. This is particularly red wines that we're talking about here, that the tannins can be very harsh when the wine is young. And when you decant the wine and let it sit for a little while, you can actually seem to soften the tannins and make the wine a little more drinkable. It's really the same effect as you would get if you were to swirl the wine in the glass, except that, you know, it's sort of done ahead of time.
So it's like instant aging.
Well, not exactly, because aging is a very complex, slow process, but it's bringing the wine around a little bit and making it a little more pleasant when it otherwise might be too harsh.
Uh-huh.
When a wine is older, you would decant it really not for aeration at all. In fact, instead of decanting it an old wine, instead of decanting it maybe half an hour before the meal, the way you might do with a young wine, you want to decant it at the very last minute. And the purpose of decanting here is to pour the clear wine off the sediment that's formed in the bottle. The sediment is solid matter that forms during aging. So we're talking about wines that have already aged in the bottle. And you keep them standing upright for about 24 hours before you decant them so that the sediment falls to the bottom. And then you very carefully pour off all the clear wine, looking at the bottle. Often you can have a flashlight under the bottle so you can see where the solid sediment starts. And then you leave that behind in the bottle, and what you've poured off is clear wine, and it's ready to drink.
Are there specific wines that kind of say decant me to you?
Yes, and basically they are in the tannic red genre. So we're talking about red Bordeaux, Barolo, Brunello, Hermitage from France, young Cabernets, young Syrahs. And when they're young, they need to be decanted to soften their tannins. And when they're older, they usually have thrown a lot of sediment, and they need decanting for that reason. So it's young tannic reds in general.
Do you ever decant white wines?
I'm glad you asked that, because actually I believe that there are some white wines that can benefit from decanting for the purpose of aeration. In other words, they're too young and they need to be brought round a little bit. I really like to decant my Alsace whites, especially if they're, you know, better, you know, Grand Cru maybe, Alsace whites. I find that they, with, you know, half an hour of air or so, that they really are more enjoyable than they would be otherwise. That's a little controversial, though. Most people think of decanting just for red wines.
But, Mary, couldn't you just open the bottle and let the wine sit there on the table?
Well, you could, but, you know, Lynn, when you think about it, the surface area of the wine, it's about the size of a quarter when it's sitting in a bottle and the bottle's full, and that's not going to get very much air into the wine. You'd be far better off, really, to pour it into another decanter. The action of pouring will aerate the wine, and then as it sits in the decanter, it will continue to get more air.
Okay, now, but will decanting help a wine that's perhaps not so great, a bad bottle, a mediocre wine?
What decanting will do for mediocre wine, actually, is that it will get the label off the table so that your guests can't see that you're serving them a mediocre wine.
Mary, thank you.
Thank you.
Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan is co-author with her husband, Ed McCarthy, of the Wine for Dummies series of books. Well, coming up, behind the scenes of the new film Dinner Rush, eating out is a political statement, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Thank you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. A new food film has come out. It's called Dinner Rush, and it's about one night in the life of a hot, trendy Italian restaurant in New York's Tribeca neighborhood. It's got a little bit of everything. There's sex, murder, a father-son conflict, and a whopper of a surprise ending. But for me, what stands out in the film is maybe the most realistic portrayal of what a restaurant kitchen is like on a busy night, especially when a food critic is in the room. We have the director and producer of Dinner Rush, Bob Giraldi, with us. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Bob, you come out of the advertising business. Why a film about a restaurant?
I think I'm still in the advertising business. That's true. I do come out of it, but I direct television commercials and have for a long time and still do. And I... done music videos. You know, film directors like to do as many different, they don't like to stay just in their own little, you know, place. I also happen to be a restaurateur. I own some of Manhattan's, I like to think, nice restaurants. I've been a restaurateur for a long time and partners with some very, you know, smart gentlemen and good chefs. And I've always had my own feelings about the restaurant business. And the script came to me that was about the business, but it was in Chicago. And it was written by two young men in Chicago, and we tried to mount it, tried to get it, you know, Hollywood get interested in it and blah, 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 the way you do these things. And nobody really cared until we took it and brought it to New York and wrote about a restaurant in Tribeca and a way of life in Tribeca, which is so much a part of this film.
Well, you shot the film in your restaurant.
Absolutely.
What was that like?
It was exciting. It was at that time the energy was up. I never took the whole restaurant the whole day. I would shoot daytime and then get out by six and give myself night, you know, the night trade, or I did nighttime and got out by lunch.
So you were shooting like in the morning, you know, like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, we were shooting in the morning and we shoot during the day. You could only do that with a non-reservation type. Neighborhood walk-in type restaurant.
So those kitchen scenes that I love so much, were they actual? I mean, was that real stuff going on?
It's real stuff going on, and actually half of the stuff they're cooking is real, that the people ate that night. So I bothered, because half the actors in the movie are really, you know, especially down in the kitchen where you can kill yourself, literally, if you don't, you know, you can burn yourself, get injured if you don't know what you're doing. Those knives are sharp, and those fires are hot. So I used real chefs and real you know, line cooks and blah, 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 and mixed with actors. And it's small down there. And that particular kitchen, I hate to say this, but it's really like a little bit of a war zone. It's, you know, it's a lot of combat down there. It's, you know, lots of macho people and one guy, the dictator, getting his way, but a lot of egos and personalities and cultures and language stuff. You know, that doesn't happen that way in the more refined French kitchens, but it certainly happens that way in the sort of trattorias.
Let's talk about what happens when the restaurant critic comes in.
Well, I had that design for her to, and I cut it out of the film, for her to come in, this particular character played by Sandra Bernhardt, who I thought, you know, sort of personifies the New York female.
Yes.
And that character was inspired by two strong-willed, very talented women who I'm sure you know.
And women who are food critics.
And food, you know, the two of the most high-profile female food critics of New York inspired this role. And but when I talked to Sandra, I said, Sandra, be yourself. That's who that is. And that's who you are. And she loved it. She just had that power and exuded all that power. And it was a, you know, it's a role that I have experienced in real life as a restaurateur. And what I wanted to say something about it, you know, in a subtle way through personality, she's in the script. I mean, you can't have a full total evening and an exciting night, one night of a restaurant without honest to goodness food critic. And when I first did the scene, I had her come in the lady at the desk open up the drawer and take out a picture, because a lot of restaurants keep pictures of these feared critics at the front of the house. And I shot that scene when Sandra left to go sit down. The front of the house lady opens the drawer, takes out a picture, looks at it and checks it, and it is Sandra with a different hairdo. Sandra was a great sport about putting on a bad wig. Not that I want to say anything about that, in terms of real critics, but it was a bad wig.
Is this what really happens in a restaurant? I mean, A, you know it's the critic is there, and B, chaos to cater to this person.
And C, they dress silly, like they're in disguise. That all happens. Yes, that's exactly that. They come in and they try to be somebody else, but not too much, because they have to be known in order to be, to be important. And I really don't think they like to go that incognito. They don't want to go sit in the corner, really.
Well, is there any revenge for you in this film?
there's revenge as a theme in the movie. There's revenge as a theme in my life, but that's personal revenge. I don't want to get into that. Not really, because all restaurant critics have been very good to the restaurants that I've been involved, so I have nothing to be upset about. They've been terrific, so I have no revenge there. I just have a point of view about who they are and what they demand and how they go about their business, like I did with a lot of the people in the film. The art critic, who's sort of a pretentious ass who just has to have what he wants, when he wants it, how he wants it. And doesn't that remind us of a lot of people in New York?
Who is your favorite character? Is it the father, the Danny Aiello character,
who is
the father
character.
Of the chef?
Yeah, Danny is my favorite character, because I relate to Danny Aiello, and that character was inspired by my flesh and blood, my Uncle Ralph DeLucia.
He's the old-time bookie, essentially, isn't he?
Yeah, he was a horse player and a bookmaker and a lovable Damon Runyon character, and I really loved him, and he inspired that character. I mean, that character is also a restaurateur. He's a bookmaker. He's Italian. He doesn't like to eat fancy. He likes to eat basic. All those things really come from a lot of stereotypes.
Yeah. Bob Giraldi, good luck with Dinner Rush, and thank you.
Thank you.
Bob Giraldi is director of Dinner Rush. Now, by the way, those two restaurant critics he referred to, well, if you guessed Gail Green of New York Magazine and Ruth Reichel, former critic for the New York Times, now editor of Gourmet, you were right on. Now, Bob left us a recipe from a book by his mom. It's called Minnie's Kitchen. The recipe is Minnie Giraldi's baked ziti with ricotta. It's like lasagna without all the work. Now, you can get the recipe on our website, splendidtable.org. There's a website that's pretty well known in the food world. It's called chowhound.com. It's the creation of New York food writer Jim Leff. He defines the difference between foodies and chowhounds as foodies eat where they're told, chowhounds blaze trails, hunting down hidden culinary treasure. Jim invites people to share their eating experiences and their opinions. Well, recently a debate broke out on the site. We've asked Jim Leff to join us to explain. Jim, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Jim, on your website, you issued a statement. You said after September 11th that you were going to start eating at Middle Eastern restaurants in the New York area where you live to support these groups. And you got a lot of response from people who come to the Chowhound site. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I said that what spurred this on is I went into an Egyptian cafe that's a favorite of mine, run by the sweetest Egyptian guy. And everyone sort of smokes shisha, which is tobacco from water bongs, and drinks their fenugreek tea. And I found out that they had been attacked the next day on the 12th by sort of bigots, who came in and started busting up the place. And the police came And they asked the owner, you know, do you want to press charges? And he said, no. And they said, well, do you want to have your expenses reimbursed? And the owner nodded his head, sadly, no, and said, no, because, you know, I feel exactly the same way myself. I understand how they feel. And that just broke my heart. And so I just all of a sudden realized that I have cause to be ashamed of the extremists on my side, just as most restaurateurs have cause to be ashamed of the extremists on their side. What I want to do is I wanted to build a coalition of the good guys, at least in terms of food, because that's the narrow realm of the world that I'm involved in.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm eating only falafel and Afghani Oshak, and I'm going to try to show these guys that we're not all like that, and that we know that they're not all like that. And so I put up this plea on the site urging everyone to get out and eat, because that's what we do. We're chow hounds, and we try to throw our consumer weight to the good guys. That's what we're about. We don't follow the hype. We try to support the good guys who are cooking really well, and this is just another way to support them. So I put up this plea, and a lot of people really agreed strongly, and all of a sudden there was talk about Afghani dinners all over the country, which was very satisfying. But a few people were kind of put off by it.
Well, yeah, I printed out 32 pages worth of responses, but someone here said, if this were December 8th, 1941, I wouldn't be eating at a Japanese restaurant.
Right.
So tell me about some of the dissension.
Well, we got some nut jobs. Just, you know, we got people sending hate mail to people, you know, just completely over-the-top bigotry. And I kind of, you know, in terms of making points, I'll kind of ignore that. The most well-informed dissent was this: how do you know when you're eating in an Afghani restaurant that you're not supporting people who support the Taliban? And, you know, what I said to that is that I can't vet the restaurant. All we can hope to do is counteract the hatred that's been spawned by going out and indiscriminately giving our support and respect to our neighbors, and that I am not personally... I don't personally think ill of him for his religion or his background. And I think that anybody that does that keeps good people on our side. And we have about 5 billion good people on our side right now. And I'd like to keep as many on that side as possible.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, a political take on eating out. And thank you for sharing it with us.
My pleasure.
Food writer Jim Leff is the creator of the website chowhound.com. Comedian and writer Catherine Michon has written a book called The Girl Genius Guide to Life. It's based on the premise that if you call yourself a genius and spread the word, you are one. This philosophy spreads also into all walks of life, including the kitchen.
I'm a girl genius. I'm a girl genius because I say I am. Now, I declared myself to be a girl genius based on no IQ test or empirical evidence of any kind, really. I just got sick of waking up every morning and feeling like a fat, wheezing pig and a loser. Now, I decided that cooking can be a girl genius activity once I emphatically declare that it is. And it's even more geniusy if I cook competitively. So that's why I now enter cooking contests of all kinds. That is how I used my genius to make peace with the domestic arts. I turned it into a contest. And you should, too. Now, as a result of my competitive cooking frenzy, I am here to report that for the 4th year in a row, I have come in 3rd at the live salad-making competition at the Santa Barbara County Fair. Once again, I'm bringing home the bronze. It's like I've become the Liu Chen of salads. Actually, the whole live salad-making frenzy started when my friend Pam, a brilliant girl genius comedy writer, suggested that a bunch of us who are frustrated in our show business aspirations should enter the county fair in cooking competitions. Because at least the salads, unlike the television shows and movies that live in our head, would get made. Now I find, after 4 long years, that I am as bitter about the whole world of live salad making as I am about show business. Live salad making is very political. It's all about who you know. Anyway, the 1st year of the competition, I made Catherine's Girl Genius low-fat Technicolor tater salad. It's made with red potatoes, white potatoes, yellow potatoes, and purple potatoes, and red peppers, yellow peppers, purple peppers, and green peppers, and it is a sight to behold. And it wasn't just a salad. I felt it was a witty commentary on the artificiality of the American dream. As I prepared it live on stage, I wore a tiara with small new potatoes on it, which I insisted on calling my palmed tiara. Not that any of those plebeian lowbrow hack judges got any of it. Now, my friend Pam wore all black with a tasteful necklace of pearl onions. Classy. Smart. Her salad was all about the false comfort of the bourgeoisie. Her salad was entitled The 1980s Wretched Excess Retro Surf and Turf Salad. Now, it took $97 worth of ingredients to make, including lobster, steak, caviar, and deviled eggs, and basically amounted to nothing so much as a bribe on a plate. And it was a bribe those judges were happy to take because they gave her second place, although they completely missed the tongue-in-cheek irony of both our salads. They just ate them. Now, this is where the story gets really sad and bitter, like so many of my stories. My girl genius friend Cassandra was also in the contest. Now, Cassandra actually wore a full sari, complete with third eye dot, and it was obvious to all discerning salad eaters that she clearly deserved to win first prize with her Indian monsoon masala salad, which was a wry homage to the spirituality that is India. But she got completely hosed. I mean, she didn't even place. And do you know why? I'll tell you why. Because her salad was just too hip for the room. That's why. I know, because after the competition, I confronted one of the judges, a certain Mrs. Peggy Kiefer, and here's what she had to say about Cassandra's salad. Well, I liked it, you know, but it just had too many flavors. Too many flavors. Too many flavors for the simple-minded palate of Mrs. Peggy Kiefer. Of course, it should come as a surprise to no one that the woman who won first place just happened to be friends with... yes, you guessed it, a certain judge named Mrs. Peggy Kiefer. Anyway, this year, the theme of the fair was California diversity, a theme I embraced by wearing my trademark tiara covered with flags of all the nations of our Pacific Rim neighbors. I made Catherine's Girl Genius Can't We All Get Along salad. It was made entirely out of vegetables that represent all of our beautiful cultures in the melting pot, or in this case, the cold platter, that is California. As always, there was a message in my roughage. But still, I'm third. And who won? Well, the astute listener will see this one coming. Yes, a certain Mrs. Peggy Kiefer's new pet, Michelle Nasberg. And what did she make? Certainly, the prize-winning salad must have been exotic beyond our wildest fancies, right? Guess again. She made just a plain old tossed salad. That's right. You heard me correctly. A sad and greasy tossed salad with shaved carrots, just like you'd get on your salad from, oh, let's say Burger King. But of course, her winning touch was her special hemp seed dressing. That's right. The judging has reached a new low wherein lobster and caviar aren't big enough bribes. Now you actually have to provide these craven judges with illicit drugs in your salad. So perhaps next year, just to cling to my pitiful third place, I'll be expected to whip up a little Niçoise crack salad with my famous crystal meth vinaigrette. We'll see.
One way.
Catherine Michaud is author of The Girl Genius Guide to Life and hosts the television program Girl Genius Night at the Movies, opposite Monday Night Football on AMC. Well, it's time for our weekly food challenge. Here's today's food question. What do the following have in common? Arthritis, chemotherapy, and candy. We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Now, we'll be opening the lines for your call, so you can give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's food question. The question was, what do the following have in common? Arthritis, chemotherapy, and candy? Well, it's chilies. Specifically, the substance that makes them hot. It's called capsaicin. Now, doctors prescribe a cream that contains capsaicin for some arthritis sufferers. Rubbing it into joints helps relieve pain. As far as chemotherapy and candy go, in 1994, researchers at Yale University Medical School created a chili butterscotch taffy to help relieve mouth pain for people receiving chemo. There's a lot of research going on all over the world about how chilies mute pain. Now, there's another thing about chilies and pain. If chilies are too hot for you, you can train your neurotransmitters not to communicate that heat. You start by eating mild chilies like anchos, and you gradually work up to hotter ones like serranos. Now, I've got a training recipe for the rookies out there. It's sautéed pork in chili orange sauce. It was inspired by this great Mexican cook from San Antonio. His name is Ron Bechtol. You can get this recipe, pork with chili orange sauce, on our website, splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Houston on the line. Houston, what do you want to talk about?
I want to take advantage of your experience in the kitchen. One of our godchildren is 23, and she'll be graduating from college and pretty soon, and I'll probably want to move away from home. And we want to do something generous. We want to stock her kitchen. We're thinking of pots and pans and maybe a set of kitchen, you know, of utility knives. And we're not talking about yard sale stuff.
You are really generous, aren't you?
Yeah, well, we don't have kids of our own, so we spoil other people's children.
Oh, I understand that. Well, okay, so are you saying sort of what should you get her?
Yeah, I'm asking for suggestions. We're thinking of not just a starter set, but I don't want to be too elaborate. I wouldn't go as far as buying a paella pan, but the basic kind of things that would last her lifetime. I want really good quality stuff.
I understand. Does she like to cook?
Well, she'll need to.
She'll need to.
Yeah,
okay.
She does. The only thing I know about is lasagna, but.
Well, yeah, but that's a good start.
Yes, it is.
I think basically, you know, I'm going to make this real simple for you. Think okay. One brand. I think one of the good brands out there, durable, not wildly high priced, mm-hmm. is All-Clad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah,
store.
And it's good stuff, and it's easy to handle, and it conducts heat beautifully. And I think if you're going to buy her a basic set. And you don't want a set. You want to put this together. You want a 10-inch sauté pan, a 4-quart saucepan, and maybe a 12-inch sauté pan because she can use that as a baker. You know, she can put it in the oven as a roaster, or she can use it on top of the stove. Those three things, a paring knife and an 8-inch chef knife.
Just those two knives?
Just those two knives to start out. Believe it or not, she may be very surprised that she needs much else. If you want to splurge, you could get her a bread knife or a carving knife.
Yeah, because we do kind of want to splurge.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But I'm talking about a paring knife that's going to cost you maybe $60 by Henkel or Wusthof. So you may want to give her those two good knives. She will have them the rest of her life, and she'll have the pots the rest of her life.
Yes.
I think this is a good start for you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome, and what a lucky young woman she is. I wish I had gotten parents like you when I was that age. Houston, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye. You know, if you're going to treat somebody to one good piece of equipment that they're going to use constantly, as far as I'm concerned, it's a 12-inch saute pan. That's the straight-sided big fry pan, and ideally it has a long handle, and on the opposite side it has a little handle so you can handle it easily. That, to me, is the pan. I do sauces in it, I roast in it, I do stews in it, I do everything in it. 12-inch saute pan. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up. We've got Robert on the line. So, Robert, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I've been to a restaurant here in Seattle, and what I'm looking for is how to make a balsamic cream sauce. Every time I try to make one at home, the cream ends up curdling in the vinegar, and I've tried adding different things to it, but it just never seems to work out.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, you're trying to duplicate something you had in a restaurant then?
Yes.
Tell me what it was like.
What this was is it's a smoked chicken pasta,
uh-huh.
And they use smoked chicken and porcini mushrooms, goat cheese, pine nuts, and braised spinach over pasta, and then put the balsamic cream sauce over that. It's really good.
Okay, so now tell me what you've been trying to do to make the cream sauce, and maybe we can troubleshoot.
At first, I tried sautéing chicken in a pan and leaving kind of the brown stuff at the bottom of the pan to then deglaze it with the vinegar and cook it down a little bit, and then tried adding the cream, and that immediately curdled. So I thought, well, maybe I need to add something to the vinegar to try to kill the acidity before I start adding cream. And so I've tried adding some chicken stock to it, and maybe I'm not adding enough chicken stock. I'm not sure.
Have you boiled down the vinegar so that it's almost a glaze?
Yeah.
Is it like just a very, very thin film on the bottom of the pan? Barely, barely liquid?
Usually.
Okay. And then how much cream, more or less, do you add?
Also, I haven't actually added heavy cream. I added half and half.
There's your problem.
That's the problem? I tried like a lighter milk, like a 2%, something like that.
Nah,
and I realized that's too thin.
I hate to tell you. Robert, you know, when it comes to sauces like this, the low-fat thing has just got to fly out the window. Here's the thing. What happens is when you use something like heavy cream, there's actually, for lack of a better word, and I may not be using the correct scientific term, but there's almost an emulsion that occurs.
Okay.
And the key to these things, whenever you're working with a vinegar sauce, is to boil down the vinegar until it's just a film in the bottom of the pan. You get the essence of the flavor. And then and by the way, you could add a little broth after that and simmer that for a few moments to lighten the sauce. So it's not just heavy cream with a little bit of vinegar in it. You follow what I'm saying?
That does sound good, though, but yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no. Then what you want to do is you add the cream. You've diluted some of the acidity of the vinegar. You've already diluted it by reducing it.
Mm-hmm.
Then by adding the broth to it, you've given the sauce more dimension. You've brought out another flavor to the vinegar, and you've given yourself literally more bulk. And then you add the cream, and you simmer it for a couple of minutes. But you do have to use heavy cream. 2%, half and half, all of that is just not enough fat to do the thickening process.
Well, that would explain it, yeah, because I keep trying different things, thinking it was just too acidic, and that was...
It's that the fat wasn't enough. The acid was okay, but the fat... There wasn't enough fat to balance.
Okay. Is there anything specific as far as the quantities I should be adding? Because I was always making enough for maybe 1 to 2 servings, so I was using maybe a quarter cup of vinegar.
Well, I think if you're sautéing the chicken and then you take all those nice brown crusty bits, which are important, and you add, let's say, 3 tablespoons of a decent balsamic vinegar, okay? And I'd add a pinch of brown sugar as well.
Okay.
Okay. Simmer that down to almost nothing. Add a half a cup of stock. Simmer that down by half, and then add about a quarter to a third of a cup of cream and simmer for about a minute. And taste, obviously, to see that it's the flavor you like. And if for some reason You don't have enough balsamic flavor. There's a trick chefs use all the time. They take inexpensive balsamic vinegar and some brown sugar, boil it to a syrup. Okay. And they keep that stored in the fridge. And you could put a few drops of that in at the very last moment.
That gives it a richer taste.
A richer taste,
A richer taste. Really expensive stuff for a sauce.
Exactly. So okay. Try that. The great secret of most sauces is fat, protein, and some kind of acid, whether it's wine or vinegar.
Well, great.
You just needed more fat.
I'll give that a shot. Thanks.
Okay. You take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's talk apples for a minute. It's pie season. And I'd like you to try some new apples. First of all, forget the eunuch of the apple world, the Golden Delicious. No taste. The only good thing about a golden is it holds its shape. Now, what you want from a great pie apple is tartness, and it holds its shape in cooking. So there's the dependable old Granny Smith. But then try something new. Honeycrisp, Prairie Spy, or Harrelson. By the way, this is the time to splurge on the Rolls-Royce of great cinnamon, Vietnamese cinnamon. Now, you can find it at probably many spice stores. Two that I know about, two sources are Vans and Penzies. Okay? So, think about trying a new pie apple. It's that time of year, guys. Okay, let's get back to the phones. Let's see, who's been waiting? Valerie. Hi, Valerie. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. What is on my mind is the gallons of limoncello I have in my basement that just haven't worked out correctly.
Gallons?
Gallons. Well, let me tell you why we have gallons. My husband and I spent our honeymoon on the Amalfi Coast, and like many people, fell madly in love with limoncello. Brought back two bottles and drank it in little thimblefuls and decided, well, we had to do better than that. So we decided to make a lot of it to give it as Christmas gifts, because when family and friends came by, we would also give them a little thimbleful.
Right.
Finally, when I found that I could not buy it in the United States, I found two recipes exactly the same. We followed them. Of course, we doubled them, which in retrospect might have been a mistake. And it's, you know, it's a very simple recipe. We skinned 30 lemons and the vodka, and we let it sit for 40 days, and then added the sugar and water and let it sit for 40 more days. The problem is this. I mean, I didn't...
I think you should explain to everybody what limoncello is.
Ah, okay. It's a liqueur that everyone on the Amalfi Coast drinks, and it's kind of hard to explain. It's like nothing else I've tasted. It's like the best lemonade you could ever imagine in your wildest dreams.
And it has alcohol in it.
Yes, ma'am.
When
you drink it over there, and people should be warned of that, you don't really feel that it has alcohol in it. You don't feel that in your mouth.
Uh-huh.
You feel it later, of course.
Yes, every time you try to stand up, you feel
That's exactly right. So we did all of these steps, and we waited the 40 days, And the problem is this. When we finally completed the last step, removing all the lemon peels, we put some... It tasted okay. It didn't taste like what we had in Italy, and we really didn't expect it to because we didn't have those exquisite lemons.
Right.
The problem is this. We froze a bottle so we could try it that night. We thought, well, maybe it doesn't taste really great because, it wasn't frozen. When we took it out of the freezer, it's freezing the way a slushy would freeze. Which tells me that there's something wrong. We put too much water in it.
Because if it's freezing that easily, you don't have enough alcohol.
Yeah, and
sound awfully good.
Well, it is good. I mean, I'm using it on ice cream and things like that, and it's quite wonderful, but it's not what we had in mind. The color's a little off.
Yeah.
It doesn't have that really deep kind of lemony flavor that we wanted. But now we have gallons and gallons of it, and I'm trying to figure out how to... it was amazing, first of all, I have to tell you, to peel 60 lemons. It was a lot of work. What to do, and I'm thinking, and this is what I wanted your advice on, that the only thing we could do now to salvage it would be to add more alcohol. But I'm afraid if we do that, we'll throw off the lemon flavor. So what do you think?
Well, I've never tried to make this stuff,
okay?
I've drunk it,
mm-hmm.
And it is lemon nectar. I mean, that's what
yes.
it always reminds me of, and
that's
it's sweet,
it.
But it's very lemony, and you're right. It's the lemons from that place, and they're fresh picked,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, people in California or Florida where they grow their own lemons probably have a chance at really duplicating something. But this is what I would do. I would add more alcohol, but I'd add more lemon. Because, in so many words, I'd build the whole thing so that you end up with more alcohol, but I would just throw in more of those lemons the way they told you to do it originally.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I always think we're doing something very biblical here. Give it 40 days and 40 nights. or maybe even 20 days and 20 nights and
okay.
See what you've got. In the meantime, for your slushies, I mean, uh-huh. If you say you have gallons and gallons, some of this stuff you're not going to, I mean, you're going to have to do something else with, I think, just because of the nature of the bulk you're dealing with.
Uh-huh.
Just add extra lemon juice to that and freeze it and use it, you know, and make, wouldn't it be, I mean, a sorbet?
Yes.
You know, mix it with cream and make a wonderful lemon ice cream. I mean, you could do a ton of stuff with this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To use some of it and you know, give people frozen desserts for Christmas.
There's an idea.
Yeah,
do you think to get more of a lemony flavor to it, I might add, I was thinking about, rather than peeling 25 or 40 more lemons, maybe put in some lemon extract. Do you think I should go back? No, don't go near it.
That stuff is poison.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's really toxic. It's awful to cook with.
Lemon peels and a couple more bottles.
Yeah, and if you can get your hands on some organic lemons, it would be great.
Well, I'll tell you, the reason we decided to make it, well, we wanted it for Christmas, but I happened to be at our farmer's market and just found these huge, beautiful lemons.
Oh, great.
And I thought, well, this is going to be the closest I'll get.
Yeah. Are you in California?
No, we're in Nashville.
Oh, but if you've got great, you know, I mean, if you've got beautiful lemons, you've got beautiful lemons.
We have a great farmer's market.
So
this is the perfect opportunity.
Yeah.
And I have family all over waiting for this for Christmas because we make pizzellis every year.
Oh.
And we thought, well, this year we'll send pizzellis and the limoncello.
They're that
and everybody
wonderful
will have
cookie,
a moment of Italy.
That lacy sort of shaped cookie
yes,
thingy.
Yes.
All right, this is what you do.
Okay.
You invite over your friends,
okay.
And you give them all lemon. You give them all peelers, and juicers or whatever you want. You're going to need. And what you do is, in the meantime, you make them slushies.
Okay.
From some of what you've got.
Right.
And you have the Tom Sawyer approach to painting the fence. And you tell them they do this, they get a Christmas present.
They don't do this.
It's toast.
I'll do it. I love your show. It's a wonderful show.
Thanks.
I just bought your cookbook, which is also lovely, and I thank you.
Well, I thank you, dear, and I will be thinking of you at Christmas time.
Well, I'll tell you, if it turns out okay, I'll send you a little bottle.
Oh, I'd love it.
Okay.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Lynn.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, that's it for this week, guys. I want to thank you all for joining us, and remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Albert Einstein. An empty stomach is not a good political advisor. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. Musical Wizardry by Rob Hebzinski. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.